with our special guest tonight, Mitch Horowitz, as we talk about occult America right here on Coast to Coast AM. Mitch, we're in an era now where everybody is trying to think positively, using positive thinking to get us into things. So what were the origins of that?
You know, it's really one of my favorite subjects in the book, because positive thinking is as American as apple pie. It seems to be everywhere. It's not just New Agers who are into it. You hear messages of positive and motivational thinking coming from very mainstream and evangelical Christian pulpits. Figures like Joel Osteen broadcast their services to millions of Americans on Sunday mornings, and he basically gives a positive thinking message from his pulpit. But this is a philosophy with occult roots. It is an American occult philosophy that really got its start in this country in the mid-19th century. There was a clockmaker who lived in the state of Maine named Phineas Quimby. And this man, Phineas Quimby, suffered from tuberculosis. And he noticed that when he went out for carriage rides in the countryside, as his mood would lift, as his spirits would lift, his tuberculosis would get better. And he began to ask himself, what is the connection between my mood and the illness that I feel? So Quimby began to probe this idea, and eventually he came around to the opinion that not only sickness, but bad fortune, poverty, any kind of ill tidings or tragedies in a person's life could be coming out of his or her thoughts, that the mind was causative. And if we could use the mind as an instrument, as a tool, use it in a positive way, we could determine outcomes in our lives. Quimby was interested in a mystical idea that actually traveled to the United States from Europe. It was called mesmerism. Today we call it hypnotism. But at the time, mesmerism was this practice whereby you could put a person into a trance state, and you could manipulate what was sometimes called his animal magnetism. The idea in mesmerism was that there was this invisible life force that animated all human beings and all things, and that it could be manipulated to cure diseases or to make people do all kinds of things through autosuggestion, maybe speak in foreign languages, recall past lives. All these ideas sort of got mixed together in Quimby's mind, and he formed this philosophy of mental healing. And he attracted a very famous follower who was later known as Mary Baker Eddy. She founded the Church of Christian Science, which was a mental healing ministry. And there were lots of people passing in and out of Quimby's world and Mary Baker Eddy's world, and a number of these folks broke off on their own, and they formed into a philosophy that eventually became called New Thought. And the premise of New Thought was that, again, the mind could be used as an instrument. Positive thoughts would result in negative positive thoughts would result in positive outcomes, negative thoughts in tragic outcomes, and that the mind was actually an extension of God. Our unconscious mind is an extension of the creative power of the universe. This is what we see in movies and books like The Secret today.
Right.
This became a very American philosophy. Jumping ahead a few generations, in the 1950s in this country, there was a conservative minister named Norman Vincent Peale who published a book called The Power of Positive Thinking, and you could find it in just about every household in America at one time. Norman Vincent Peale was standing directly on the shoulders of these mystic Americans from the mid-19th century who just left to their own devices, experimenting with their own ideas and using some occult and mystical ideas that had come over from Europe. They really created this idea that the mind is an instrument of magical power, of godlike power. This is what found its way into Norman Vincent Peale's book, The Power of Positive Thinking. And every generation sort of reclaims this idea for itself. It gets restated in best-selling books, in movies. It's part of every self-help program, every business motivational program. Again, you know, you hear it coming from the pulpits of very mainstream ministries. Almost everyone in America in some way or another is touched by this idea, is influenced by this idea of motivational thinking. And it was, at its birth, an American occult philosophy.
Now, with all this and this push toward this kind of thinking, you would think that a lot of people would not dabble into devices such as the Ouija board, but they are.
Oh, yeah. Come?
They seem to be enjoying it. Isn't that dangerous?
I get asked about the Ouija board more than any other item in the book, and I think there is a danger there. I hear a lot of frightening stories from people about the Ouija board. Lots of people tell me that they have experimented with the Ouija board, and sometimes they'll get communications that are reassuring or helpful in some way. The board may tell them where to find their lost car keys, but then there start to come threats. Weird things start to happen around the household. Lights start to flicker on and off by themselves, and people get scared and say, wait a minute, maybe I've unleashed something here that I don't like. And I'll tell you kind of a funny, somewhat frightening story that happened to me in connection with the Ouija board while I was working on this book. Several years ago, I was writing an article on the history of Ouija. In fact, that article is posted today on my website. And I wasn't talking to anybody about this article. I wasn't telling anybody about it. And I was just walking around thinking to myself, gee, if I'm writing this article on the history of Ouija boards, maybe I should be experimenting with a Ouija board myself. Maybe I should be using the thing. I didn't tell this to anyone. Completely out of the blue, one morning, I boot up my computer. I get this email from a woman, a complete stranger, person I've never met before in my life. And she wrote to me, I'm getting some kind of intuition that you are thinking of experimenting with a Ouija board, and I want to warn you not to do it. And she told me this terrifying story that her family had started playing around with a Ouija board, and she started receiving these threatening phone calls. There was this very frightening voice at the other end of the phone. Police later found out that the phone calls were coming from her own son, and she felt that this boy had experienced some kind of possession through using the Ouija board. But the weird thing was, for me, I didn't talk to anybody about wanting to experiment with a Ouija board. I didn't know this person. She was a perfect stranger to me, and this email just reached me out of the blue, warning me, stay away from it. That was eerie enough for me. I have used the thing a little bit, but I don't use it here in my household. And whether you believe it contacts some kind of spirits from the other world, or whether you believe it just taps into some dark areas of our own psyche, it's funny. It's a toy. It's manufactured by Parker Brothers. You can buy it in a shrink-wrap box at most large toy stores. But there are a lot of sinister and frightening stories around Ouija. And a lot of people come up to me and talk to me about it.
I was going to be doing a Ouija board experiment, Mitch, a couple years ago, and it was something I really planned to do, and I was going to have three experts with me while I did this, and one was on the fence, one said do it, and the other said absolutely not, and I ended up not doing it, and most of the people listening to that program either emailed me or sent me special computer fast blasts, agreeing with that decision not to play around with this. There was a handful that wanted it done. One, they were having a pizza party, and they had their own Ouija board ready to go. And I decided not to do it, not because I believe it would have done anything to me, but I didn't want to influence it for other people.
Yeah,
because I think there's a responsibility here.
Yeah.
You cite a story of three girls in your book. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, that was an interesting story. In the 1960s, there were these three teenage girls who sat down with a Ouija board. And, you know, this was a typical scene out of any American living room. Kids used to gather around Ouija boards for pajama parties and so on. And these three young girls asked the board, will we all get married? And the board answered, yes. And they're kind of giggling and having a good time. And
they loved the board, it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This to them was just great entertainment. And they asked the board, will there be divorces? And the board said, yes, three.
And there's three girls there, right?
And there's three girls there. So you've got three girls who are supposed to get married and divorced. Years later, when these girls had grown into middle-aged women, they discovered to their astonishment that all three of them had gotten married, but one of them had gotten divorced three times.
Three times. The other two, zero, right?
Very weird. The other two, zero. So the board was
right.
There were three marriages and three divorces, but in a way that they never could have pictured when they were teenagers. So, you know, it's the kind of story that makes an impression on people. I have mainstream folks come up to me, people from all different walks of life, telling me, look, I don't know about this occult stuff, but I've had a very scary thing happen to me in connection with the Ouija board. And actually, I have a story in the book. There was this young man who was interviewed by a group of academic researchers who were studying Ouija boards in the year 2001. And they discovered that about half of Ouija users felt a compulsion to use it. And there was an 18-year-old kid who offered these academic researchers a really chilling story. And if you don't mind, I could just read this short little passage.
I'd love to hear it.
Sure. This young man told researchers, there have been many interesting things that have happened to me using the Ouija board, but the best would be with a spirit named Kyle. He was a 60-something-year-old child molester. Ugh. I don't remember how he died, but he seems to have had some kind of connection to me. Every time I use the Ouija board, Kyle's name comes up. Most of the time, the people playing know nothing about him. Even sometimes, I'm not playing when he comes up. I think I've seen him twice in spirit form, and he once threatened to kill my half-sister. He's a complete psycho. He scares me. Strange things happen the nights we speak to him. He likes to switch lights on and off. And that was one story of many that these academic researchers found among people who use Ouija. So, to use it or not use it, it's a question a person should take very seriously.
Why does it work? Because it apparently does. It's just, as you said, a piece of cardboard, a little game. Ha ha. But it seems to work.
It seems to work. Now, if you talk to skeptics, they will tell you it's all nonsense. It's just a matter of people sitting around and moving the little planchette, the little table,
subconsciously, probably.
Right, subconsciously, it's some kind of kinetic subconscious movement, and people are just expressing the dark sides of their own psyche. Now that may very well be true. That may very well be true, but there was an American poet named James Merrill who died several years ago. James Merrill was a greatly accomplished poet who created this epic poem in 1976. Called The Book of Ephraim, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for this great epic poem. He swore until the day he died that he channeled this poem through a Ouija board. He had been using a Ouija board for 20 years, and through Ouija, he created his most celebrated and his most widely recognized poetry, and he was absolutely forthright in claiming this. So he said, look, if I'm using this thing, or if another person is using this thing, and let's say they're not contacting any kind of spirit world. Let's just say they're contacting the inner dimensions of their psyche.
Right.
Wow, what's going on in our psyches? What's going on there? If there are all these scary stories coming out, and Ouija is just a tool for contacting our inner selves, what in the world is going on inside of us? So he felt either way, whether you were contacting some kind of another being or whether you were getting in touch with something inside yourself, it was revealing something pretty strange about the world that we live in.
Amazing, amazing stuff. Now, you know, this movement of spiritualism in this country is very, very strong. And I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about just the people involved who are very spiritual. However, that does also include the occult, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Spiritualism was an occult movement in this country. You know, it really started in March of 1848. There was this lonely little log cabin outside the city of Rochester in upstate New York. And there were a couple of young teenage girls, the Fox sisters, who lived in this cabin. And there were these weird noises and bangs and rappings ringing out throughout the cabin. And this was a very ordinary mainstream Methodist household.
Okay.
And the girls told their parents, those noises, Mom and Dad, are spirit raps, and we are able to contact these spirits of dead people from the other world.
Yeah, they were doing this, right?
They said they were doing this, and lots of prominent people, including the newspaper editor Horace Greeley and clergymen and politicians, came to this little cabin. They checked it out, and they said, yes, the girls are telling the truth. So newspaper stories sprung up all over the country.
Made them heroes, right?
Made them heroes. People became fascinated by this. And I think the reason it touched people so much is that the idea that these two teenage kids could contact the other world, as people saw it, was very exciting to Americans. Americans have this do-it-yourself impulse in every area of life, including religion and including the occult. And the idea that in the 19th century, two kids in America could contact the spirit world, almost like they were some kind of biblical prophets, was very exciting to the American mind. Americans like to wrap their arms around things. They like to go out and do things themselves. So Americans decided, look, we don't need an intermediary between us and the spirit world. It was almost like the vision of the founding fathers. You know, we can just search for meaning, search for truth ourselves. So Americans started forming into seance circles. Spirit mediums started popping up in every town. And an interesting thing happened. Most of these spirit mediums were women. And spiritualism, as a movement, created the first opportunity in this country, and really in the modern world, for women to serve as religious leaders, at least of a certain sort. So that helped instigate the influence for voting rights in this country, because for the first time, women who wanted a place at the table, a place at the pulpit, a place of religious leadership, could find it within spiritualism. So you had all these voting rights activists who were flowing into spiritualism, and in the mid-19th century, you could not find a voting rights activist who had not spent some time at the seance table. And that includes the most famous, the most famous figures within the suffragette movement, like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. These were branches that grew out of the same tree, basically. Spirit mediums were involved in suffragism. Suffragettes were involved in spiritualism because it was a movement that threw open the doors for women to become religious leaders and civic leaders. And as it happens, the first female presidential candidate in this country, a woman named Victoria Woodhull, was a trance medium, was a spiritualist. In 1870, Victoria Woodhull made a historic voting rights address to Congress. She was the first woman to address a joint committee of Congress. She later told a reporter that her speech had been dictated to her in a dream by a ghostly spirit figure wearing a Greek tunic. 2 years later, Woodhull was nominated to run for the presidency by a political party that was made up of suffragists and abolitionists. So spiritualism and progressive politics, reformist politics, grew up together in this country. One fed the other. That's just another way that the occult helped shape the America that we live in today.
Is it stronger or weaker than it used to be?
That's a very, very interesting question. What happens is that as the 20th century progresses, the roots of all these occult ideas get hidden. So you have a book like The Power of Positive Thinking that seems very mainstream. Suddenly you have mainstream folks practicing things like meditation and yoga, mind-body healing, motivational thinking, not necessarily considering themselves occultists of any kind. So the occult is just as strong a current in this country as it used to be, but its roots are hidden. That's what I'm trying to get at in the book. You know, I'm trying to show that if you pull up the floorboards, you find all these occult ideas and personalities. We've just come to think of it all as being very ordinary.
Astrology, we'll talk about when we come back from the break, Ronald and Nancy Reagan. It was Nancy Reagan, though, who was more into it, right?
She was more into it, but, you know, Ronald Reagan was actually very forthright at times about being into it himself.
Did anything strange happen?
Well, you know, it's funny that I suppose the strangest thing that happened is that when Reagan became the governor of California in the year 1967, his inaugural address was at 12:10 a.m. And everybody scratched their head and say, why would Governor-elect Reagan be giving his inaugural address at 12:10 a.m.?
Not p.m., a.m., right?
That's right. That's right. Late night. And the reason was, an astrologer, a California astrologer whose name was Carol Reiter, who was a man, Carol Reiter, who the Reagans consulted, told them that that was the propitious time for Reagan to give his inaugural address.
Well, based on his 8 years as a president, that astrologer might have been right. We'll be back with more with Mitch Horowitz, the author of Occult America, next on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, Mitch Horowitz, Occult America, next hour. We'll take your phone calls with Mitch right here on Coast to Coast AM. The numbers lady who is a regular on this program, Mitch, Glynis McCants, said that Barack Obama should have been inaugurated at a different time or even maybe even a different day. as well. So I guess Reagan's experience paid off for him, huh?
It seemed to pay off. It was very interesting. The California Press Corps was scratching its head, saying, why in the world would the governor-elect be giving his inauguration speech 12:10 at night? It was because Nancy Reagan consulted with an astrologer named Carol Ryder. And in 1969, Carol Ryder became the first and only astrologer to appear on the cover of Time magazine. His name has been largely forgotten today, but at one time, he was considered the dean of American astrologers.
That is something, isn't it?
Mm.
I wonder how many other people change their path in their destiny based on astrological signs and numbers and things like that.
It's interesting. Well, Carol Ryder had a real celebrity clientele. Everybody from Ronald and Nancy Reagan to Marlene Dietrich to all kinds of politicians and movie producers were his clients. Although he made a mistake a little bit later in his career, or, you know, he was just an honest guy, depending on how you look at it. He told Nancy Reagan in 1976 that he didn't think her husband should run for the presidency. It wasn't his time yet. And so that turned Nancy off, and that got her kind of soured on Carol Ryder. And when the Reagans eventually did make their way to the White House, Nancy had a new astrologer, a San Francisco astrologer named Joan Quigley. So people remember Joan Quigley as the astrologer that Nancy Reagan was consulting while she was in the White House. But back in California, it was this man, Carol Ryder, who was a very influential guy at the time.
Jeez. Well, that's amazing work. How did you research all this?
You know, George, I just followed every thread and story that I could, and I never used the story unless I could corroborate in some way. Even though I'm writing about arcane subject matter, I really tried to use the tools of a good journalist and a good historian. I never took a story just from the mouth of one person. I tried to connect it up with something else so that I hope everything in this book is absolutely verifiable.
Tell me, though, about more of the darker aspects of the occult in this country.
Well, the truth is, the figure in this country who started the American neo-Nazi movement, the first neo-Nazi movement in the 1930s, was an occultist. And I have to be upfront about that dark side of the occult's history in this country as well.
Because it was not a good one.
It was not a good one. It was a very, very grim expression of occult ideas. There was a man in the 1920s named William Dudley Pelley. And he grew up in a poor family. He was the son of a preacher from Lynn, Massachusetts. And Pelley was an interesting guy because he grew up in a poor background, and he became a successful short story writer. He won a couple of O. Henry Awards. He then became a successful screenwriter. And interestingly enough, in the year 1929, Pelley wrote a very widely read article for a magazine called American Mercury, which had a huge readership. And this article was called 7 Minutes in Eternity. It was the first mass popular account of a near-death experience. Pelley, in many respects, was the guy who introduced the near-death experience into American culture. He said that one night he died, or he virtually died, and his astral form traveled to the spirit world. And the spirit world was filled with these higher mentors who counseled him on the secrets and the truths of life. And he wrote this article, and people were just enthralled, and they wrote into the magazine saying, hey, I've had similar experiences. But within the few years that followed, something went very, very wrong in William Pelley's mind. He said that these higher mentors, these spiritual mentors that he had met in the after realm, counseled him on all these different secrets of life, and they counseled him that a politician in Germany named Adolf Hitler was going to lead a great and portentous movement, and that this was a man who had been somehow divinely selected to accomplish great things in the world. So by the year 1933, Pelley throws his support entirely behind Hitler, and he, in this country, founds a neo-Nazi order that was called the Silver Shirts. It was a fascistic, pro-Hitler Nazi order right here in America that Pelley said he had been counseled to formulate, to create, to bring about by these spirit guides he had met in the afterworld. And this organization set the mold, set the template for neo-Nazi orders in this country for generations to follow. People who became the leaders of some of the worst hate groups in America, including the Aryan Nations and Posse Comitatus, got their start in state chapters of William Dudley Pelley's Silver Shirts. Pelley put out a very profoundly hateful and bigoted and anti-Semitic magazine called Liberation. This magazine, Liberation, influenced the anti-Semitism of a modernist poet named Ezra Pound, who served the Axis powers eventually during the Second World War. So Pelley was this strangely influential guy, very grim figure, very hateful and ugly figure, who got his ideas through out-of-body experiences, traveling to some kind of a spirit realm, so he said, where he was counseled in hatred, in bigotry, in support for Hitler, and in the founding of a neo-Nazi order. So it's a tragedy, and it's also a truth, that the neo-Nazi movement in this country got its start at the hands of an occultist.
Could you say he was an occultist or more whacked out?
Well, that's a good question. You know, as I always remind people, occultism is like any other religious tradition. It has its highest iteration and it has its lowest iteration. A person can call him or herself a Christian and preach hatred, even though Christ preached the love of one's neighbor. An occultist can say, well, you know, I got these higher messages and they told me to go out and commit acts of violence, even though you can have a figure like Mahatma Gandhi, for whom occultism was a path to visions of universal brotherhood and love and equality. So, you know, the problem is not in our thought systems. The problem is not in our religions. The problem is in human nature. There seems to be some intrinsic pull, intrinsic quality in a person, either toward love or hatred, and they embrace religions or systems as a justification for what seems to be inside of them to begin with.
Would you call those who are Wiccans occultists?
Yes, I would, and very proudly so. The Wiccan faith, I think, has been a wonderful development in this country. You know, it's interesting.
Wiccans believe in God. They believe in a male-female God.
They believe in a male-female God. They believe in spellcraft. They believe in a magical system. I mean, they really are occultists, because the key belief of an occultist is that there is this invisible world that exists alongside our own, and it can be tapped. Its powers act upon us. They can act through us. And it's a real world. It's just one that we don't see and we don't understand in our day-to-day lives. So, you know, Wiccans engage in various forms of nature worship and spell work, and I think they have a magical view of life that makes them occultists. Wicca is now an officially recognized religion, by the way, within the U.S. military forces.
Well, there was a suit drawn against them, right?
That's right, yeah. And the suit was successful. And in the year 2007, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs agreed to recognize Wicca as an official religion. And today, if a Wiccan service member either falls in combat or dies later, he or she is entitled to a burial with full military honors and a pentagram on his tombstone. And if you go to the website of the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, you can see that if you are a member of the Wiccan faith, you can actually select a pentagram. It's right there on the website to have on your tombstone. And for years, there have been Wiccan chaplains and Wiccan prayer books within the military. Several years ago, the Air Force did a survey of the religious beliefs that were held by its members, and they discovered there were almost 2,000 people just in the Air Force alone who declared Wicca as their religion. But this, to me, is a sign of America's success, because all these different faiths can live and function together successfully. It's not something to be frightened of. The military functions very successfully. There's a great esprit de corps within the military, and you can have Wiccans.
As long as our political leaders stay out of it.
That's right. And, you know, people of these very different faiths can serve side by side and do so successfully.
And the faith, the Wiccan faith, was misconstrued again as being Satanistic.
That's right. And again, I think that these terms, you know, Satan.
You don't use, I know you don't use those terms.
Yeah.
I mean, but they're out there.
They're out there. They're out there. You know, they're thrown around as epithets, as curse words. There are certainly a few people who will identify themselves as Satanists or worshipers of Lucifer, but deep within Western history, those terms really emerged from the church sort of pointing fingers at ancient pagan worshipers and saying, you're doing the wrong thing. Wiccans have nothing to do with Satanism or the dark side. I would say, above all else, they're nature worshipers.
How did they get such a bum rap?
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of fear that feeds into people's beliefs about members of different faiths and paranoia, finger-pointing. I mean, we were discussing Salem earlier. You know, in the town of Salem, in the mid-1600s, there were bad winters. There were seasons where crops went bad. People were suffering. There were Indian attacks on villages. The village of Salem is just a case in point. There was paranoia. There was fear. And people looked to point fingers at those who were different. So, you know, we hear these things about Wicca, and people who belong to different religions or minority religions can sometimes make an easy target. Also, you know, the Wiccans will use a symbol like the pentagram. I was saying that, you know, the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs will permit Wiccans to have a pentagram on tombstones.
Right, and that has been overused and also misconstrued.
Yes. And, you know, it's a powerful symbol. It's a magnetic symbol. There's even though the pentagram is an ancient symbol, it hasn't lost that crackle of energy. There's something about it that excites people. And there's also something about it that scares people. What is it in this five-pointed star that's so fearsome, that's so frightening? You know, I think it's a powerful symbol, and people don't really know, gee, how do we understand this? How do we incorporate this into our lives?
Well, the swastika, before the Nazis used it as their logo,
that's right,
was a design that was well-recognized.
Well-recognized. It was a Hindu symbol of rebirth and renewal. It was a very beneficent image. Not anymore. We've lost that symbol forever, I think. The Nazis twisted it into something obscene. They destroyed it. Although, you know, it's still used today as a Hindu symbol, but I think here in the West, it's lost to us forever.
Mitch, for years, as a 21-year-old reporter in Detroit, I would do an interview around Halloween with a witch named Gundella.
Uh-huh.
And she was just a delightful old lady. I mean, it was fun every year. You know, she's dead now, but every year I'd go do an interview with her, and she'd conjure up spells and stuff, and it was great. I never went into her house, though, for fear that I'd end up being a gingerbread cookie or something.
There are all these scary fairies.
You never know.
But I'll tell you, I try to raise my kids to have a positive attitude towards the occult. And there's a wonderful movie that was made in 1970 by Walt Disney called Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Yes.
In which Angela Lansbury played a British witch. So instead of Hansel and Gretel, we read and we watch Bedknobs and Broomsticks. I think it's a better alternative for kids.
However, not to be confused with what really does occur here and in other societies, primarily among the very elite and the very wealthy, black masses. That happens.
Well, that does happen. That does happen.
I mean, look at Eyes Wide Shut, for crying out loud.
Yeah,
that's real.
Yeah. I think it's a small, small sliver of folks. I mean, I think...
Need a lot, Mitch.
You don't need a lot. But I think most occultists that you meet are liberal, open folks. They use magic. They use tarot. They use divination. But, you know, it's funny, George. In this country, you have a very interesting strain of occultism. From the very early days of this nation up through the present day, you have occultists who still identify with some of the Christian faiths and mainstream faiths. You also have a separate occult culture, but even that occult culture, by and large, has a kind of beneficent, a sort of Judeo-Christian moral outlook. In the black masses and some of that stuff, I think, is confined to a very small group of people. American occultists have always had more of an interest in self-help than in contacting dark forces.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. Fascinating work. We're going to take phone calls with you at the top of the hour. With everything that you've done when you put together Occult America, which one area fascinated you the most?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. You know, my hero and the person I write about quite a bit in the book is a psychic named Edgar Cayce.
Oh, yeah, that name comes up a lot. My hero, too, by the way.
Yeah, he lived and worked in the early part of the 20th century, and he, for much of his career, was a medical clairvoyant. He would go into a trance state from which he would diagnose people's diseases, prescribe cures, and there are just thousands and thousands of examples of his success at doing this. And Cayce was this remarkable figure. He spent most of his life in poverty. He was a very warm, loving man. He was a Sunday school teacher. He was a Sunday school teacher at a Disciples of Christ church, another guy who's an example of what could be called a Christian occultist. Cayce would have been the first one to say, I am a devout Christian. But in his trance states, and in some of his waking states too, he talked about reincarnation, clairvoyance, past lives, all kinds of different magical systems and ideas. In many ways, the reason that we have words like reincarnation and clairvoyance and meditation in this culture are due to Edgar Cayce. He introduced these ideas into America in their most popular variants. And he gave 14,000 of these clairvoyant readings, and there's just overwhelming evidence that he had some really mysterious faculty in which he was able to look into people's lives, look into people's what was going on in their bodies, and understand something about an illness and a cure that eluded medical science. Sometimes he would just be given the name and address of a person. He would lay down into a trance state, and he would talk about these intimate details of their bodies and what was wrong with them and what they could do to cure themselves. And people would come back to him again and again, and there are many success stories. So I became enthralled with Cayce, and he was the one who introduced the term channeling into our culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, this ultimately killed him. You know that. He just couldn't stop, and it just wore him down.
That's right. He died of exhaustion in a certain way. He used to do multiple readings a day. He got very little rest. He was paid very little, and he just exhausted himself. He died a relatively young man in 1945, just as the Second World War was drawing to a close. But he introduced channeling into this culture, into this country. He was the one who used the word channel. And I think right now, at this very time, we are living through a kind of revolution in channeling. Channeling is going on in every town, in every city, all over this country. There's all kinds of channel teachings in which people are claiming to contact entities from other dimensions, angels or spirits or mysterious guides or masters. This is a spiritual explosion that I think is going to reverberate through this society as much as the New Age did when it first burst onto the American scene in the late 60s and 70s. So I think that the seeds that Edgar Cayce planted are really just beginning to sprout in earnest right now. He was so influential, but I think that channeling is becoming this vast spiritual trend in America. It's something to really watch. It's going to change our spirituality in some way.
You very briefly, just a brief mention of Harry Houdini.
Yes.
And, you know, as you know, he was obsessed with the occult. He
was obsessed
with mediumship. He died never finding what he believed to be the real medium.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, for me, one of the tragic things about Houdini is that among stage magicians, he created this idea that if you're a stage performer or a stage magician, you must therefore be an opponent of any who claim to be an occultist. He kind of set a trend. He created a generation of stage magicians, several generations, who don't believe in magic. And, you know, they take a very black and white view of it. There are no questions there. There are only hardened answers. It's all nonsense. To some extent, that comes from Houdini. Now, there's no doubt that Houdini did ferret out a lot of con artistry, a lot of fakery, a lot of nonsense. But, you know, that kind of stuff has always existed in religion. What you don't want to do is let your skepticism kill your question. You have to draw a line between skepticism and cynicism. There can still be a room for questioning there. And so I think Houdini left stage magic in this very hardened place where all of the supernatural was thereafter considered nonsense.
We'll talk more about occult America when we come back. Plus, we'll open up the phone lines for you. Then in the final hour of our program tonight, 2012, or maybe 2112, we'll be back.